Ladies and gentlemen, your conference call is about to begin. Here is your moderator, Raymond Ibrahim.
Thank you, Karen, and thank you all for joining us today for another Middle East Forum conference call. Our guest today is Adam Pechter, a Yale graduate with a master's thesis on Arab political polling, and also my predecessor. As many of you will recall, he used to be the former host of the conference call series. Today he will be discussing some significant data gathered from Egypt and Jordan regarding a number of relevant issues affecting the Middle East today. Thanks for joining us, Adam. Do proceed.
Ray, thank you very much. It's great to be here this afternoon. As you might have seen in the letter that went out, before I got involved in Middle East affairs, I had a nine-year career, in New Jersey government and politics. I was the policy director for a governor. I ran a large department in New Jersey government. And I saw firsthand how effective political polling can be, not just to win elections, but for strategic message purposes, for evaluating programs, many different things. And when I switched over to Middle East affairs, I started researching Arab political polling to see sort of the lifeblood of my old business, how it was applied to the new. Now, there are two main criticisms of Arab political polling. The first is, how could you possibly elicit good opinion data from people living in authoritarian environments, scared of the Mukhabarat or secret police to speak their minds? The other criticism is that seemingly the regimes themselves don't seem to care about what their own people think, so why should we really care about it? In doing my research, I discovered that there was another side of the story, that over the last 30 years, off and on, very reputable sources, governments, agencies of these governments, have been using Arab political polling effectively for informational purposes. Let me give two quick examples. Before the first Gulf War, the U.S. Information Agency was actually polling in Syria, surreptitiously polling in Syria and Egypt, the streets of these countries to see if they would be supportive of sending Arab troops along with the United States to liberate Kuwait. And the findings were positive in many of the cases, and the U.S. Information Agency and the State Department through it used it as a way to sort of prod the regimes towards supporting us in the first Gulf War and sending Arab troops to help. A second example was that actually the Israelis had been polling in the Palestinian territories for almost 10 years before the first Intifada, and they could see the anger rising in the Palestinian territories. They chose not to act on that data. And if you talk to a lot of people involved from back then in Israel today, they'll tell you that they regret not having actually used the numbers and believed in the numbers at the time. So the other thing I learned in my research is that a lot of the polling you see today, a lot of the Arab polling you see today in the media or even within the government, isn't really being done for informational purposes for a variety of reasons. First of all, a lot of these companies want to get headlines. They have political agendas. I've seen a lot of leading questions in surveys that you wouldn't believe by very reputable companies from the outside. What do you admire the most about Al-Qaeda is the question I've seen. How big a problem is the Arab-Israeli conflict? I mean, these really are leading questions and are generating large responses that aren't indicative of sort of maybe how the people are thinking. Secondly, a lot of the companies are doing it in concert with the regimes, and the respondents know this. They know the governments are involved. A lot of times they know American polling companies are behind this, and it's throwing off wildly throwing off the samples. There are other problems. Suspect methodology. A lot of firms use phone polling. They use internet polling. When, if you talk to any of the experts, only face-to-face polling in people's homes is effective in the region because of the nature of the authoritarian nature of these countries. And two months ago, I saw a survey that said a phone poll was done of Saudi Arabia where 95% of the people said they supported the king. That, you know, really doesn't have much informational value whatsoever when done methodologically and properly. There's other problems with that I could go into. You know, frequently these polling companies don't poll enough, so you don't have much reliability. I mean, a polling company may poll once a year or once every other year, and the data is all over the place. Moreover, a lot of times they lump countries together. So it's very hard, you know, each of these countries has their own identity, their own series of issues that they believe in, and you can't really see it both in the questionnaire and in the data that comes back. So there's a whole litany of problems with Arab polling today. So what I decided to do is, 2 months ago, I decided to form my own Arab polling company, Pector Middle East Polls, and I went down to Washington and met with David Pollack, who in my research was actually one of the pioneers in the field. He's at the Washington Institute. Many of you may know him. We wrote up 12 questions together. And, you know, writing a questionnaire, especially in the Arab world, is a real art form. Just how you structure the survey, how you ask questions so that they really elicit the best information, how you relax respondents. So we worked for a long time in developing this questionnaire. Then I secured a field organization that does consumer-based research in the region without regime approval to do a poll of Egypt and Jordan. It was very important that we found a group that does not seek regime approval, that only does face-to-face interviews in people's homes, that had a long track record of working and providing effective information that I had sort of uncovered in my research. I then went over to Jordan. The poll was from June the 15th to the 28th. I was over there for a lion's share of it. And I could not go on the interviews because that would throw off the sample. But I was able to sit in the field office, and I was able to. There were, every time a poll goes in the field, there are problems. Most of the time, there are problems at its inception. I was able to sit there and work through the problems. I was able to debrief the field workers. I was able to see how they were doing things statistically. I was able to sort of meet everybody involved in the operation. And after I came back and the preliminary results came back and word got out about this, we actually got a large amount of attention, which is continuing to this day. I mean, considering also that this was my first survey, because we were in the field June the 15th through the 28th, which was soon after two major events in the region, the first being the June 4th speech by the president in Cairo, and second, the Iranian elections. And David and I developed questions that the whole survey wasn't about those two events, but the end of the survey focused on those two events, and we had great data specifically on those two, and it seems as if no one else was in the field. I know Pew was dovetailed a little bit with the president's speech. They started polling a couple days before and had some data after it. But we haven't found anyone else that was in the same time frame we were in and asked such specific questions that we did. So I've actually sent everyone who's signed up for the call the actual top-line results that I got back from the field, from Egypt and Jordan. Somebody said to me, why don't you send around a PowerPoint presentation? And I find that the results that you have in front of you, spelling mistakes and all, because these were native Arab speakers translating back into English, are actually much more effective to see how we're going to do this differently going forward. Because a lot of the way of eliciting good information from respondents is how you structure the survey, how you relax respondents, and sort of where you position questions. So if I just could take another couple minutes, I can go over the highlights of the survey as you see it in front of you. There's both Egypt and Jordan. If you lay it out in front of you where you're sitting, you can compare both results. The first question we asked was a question about which foreign leader do you admire most? And this is a typical question that you'll see in a lot of Arab political surveys. Zoghbi frequently asked this question. Most recently, he did a survey in the spring, and Hugo Chavez got 35% of the vote. And this was very curious to both me and David Pollack. And we wanted to see, to really just test this result and see what kind of results we'd get back if we just asked the question straight up as an open-ended question and had them the respondents fill it in. And if you look at the data, the first thing you'll notice is that the responses were very diverse. I mean, there was not one leader that got a lion's share of the vote. Moreover, I mean, if you look at it, in Egypt, there were 20 leaders between 2 and 11%. And in Jordan, there were 24 leaders mentioned between 2 and 9%. So it's really a diffuse group of leaders chosen. Moreover, if you look at the top, the number one choice in both countries was King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia. So a lot of these surveys will say, look at this rejectionist leader, look at this Islamist leader that gets a lion's share of the vote. If you look in these cases, both surveys have a relative moderate at the head of the survey. Moreover, if you look at Egypt, King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia and King Abdullah of Jordan get 19%, close to 1 in 5 respondents, are selecting relatively moderate leaders as compared to other surveys that you've seen. In Jordan, the respondents couldn't select Abdullah because they had to select a foreign their own Abdullah because they had to select a foreign leader. So you see. So other things you'll notice in the first question is where Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is. You know, he did well compared to other people on the list, but he got 6% in one country, 8% in another, a far cry from where you saw him when he first started as president of Iran. And also you'll notice where Barack Obama fits. His numbers were lower than I would have anticipated at 3 and 4% respectively in Egypt and Jordan. Going through the rest of the survey very quickly, you know, questions 2 through 6 are more consumer-based questions. We wanted to see if there was a correlation between feelings toward the United States politically and whether it was affecting the buying of American products, the recognition of American products, the usage of American entertainment and media sources. And this part of the survey has gotten a lot of attention within the a lot of people who in the intelligence community, also in the business community, they're very interested in this data. But I think more of the political audience, which this may be, might not be as interested in these questions. But one of the reasons I wanted you to see this is because we put these questions in there to sort of relax the respondents until we got to more politically charged stuff later on in the survey. If you look at questions 7 and 8, these are very, very interesting. Most Arab political surveys will ask whether or not the respondents like the United States. And I felt that it was very important that we also had a question that prefaced that favorability question about whether or not the respondents cared about having good relations with the United States. And if you look at the data we got back, it's very interesting because in Jordan, it seems that the respondents seemed to feel that it was very important to have good relations with the United States. 53 to 43% said that they should have good relations with the United States. But when you saw the favorability ratings, there was a very unfavorable rating for the United States. So the relationship was important, but they didn't seem to like us as much in Jordan. Whereas in Egypt, it was the reverse. The relationship was not as valued. 36 valued the relationship, whereas 51 did not seem to value it as much. Whereas the favorability ratings were up at the 38% level, which were very high compared to previous surveys we saw during the Bush administration. And one of the reasons we've heard back from our field operators in Jordan and other places is the aid issue may be playing into effect about the relationship with the United States, that people have, you know, have been hearing that we've been giving them $3 billion a year, have not been seeing the results, and don't really value the relationship as much with the United States. Yet they actually, because the president gave a speech in Egypt, and the population's different than that of Jordan, where there's a lot more Palestinians in the population, America may be actually on an upspring favorability-wise. Moving on to the stuff that's gotten the most attention are questions 9 through 12. Question 9 and 10 focuses on the president's speech in Cairo. And the real story with question 9 is the fact we were able to get such data back so quickly on the president's speech, on each one of his specific proposals and credibility from both of these countries. I went back and looked during President Bush's time when Condoleezza Rice was in Cairo and previous presidents. It's very rare that you get opinion data at all a lot of the government agencies really wanted to see this. They didn't have it themselves from shortly thereafter the president's speech. And I actually think there's some good news for the president in these numbers. You know, if you look at his credibility rankings in Egypt, he's getting between 30 to 40% feeling him credible on most of the issues he articulated in the speech, where if you look at the not credible at all numbers, which are people who really aren't going to give him a chance, they're hovering between 20 and 25%. Jordan's a little different. You see a little bit more lesser numbers there, and the numbers really drop off when you mention the Arab-Israeli conflict, because of the Palestinian demographic in Jordan, which makes up approximately 70% of the population and of the survey ethnically. And then moving quickly to the last two questions, probably question 12 has gotten the most attention, and that's the question if the respondents would support would push their governments to support increased Western sanctions against Iran if they do not stop building their nuclear program by the end of the year. Never before have we seen in Arab political polling the streets of these countries supportive of increased sanctions. Both Egypt and Jordan, the governments of these the regimes, are are Sunni regimes. There's no love lost for the Iranians, but the streets of these countries have been very supportive of Ahmadinejad and the regime in Tehran. Especially at the beginning, or during the Holocaust denial stuff, you saw their Iranian numbers quite high, and you've never seen them actually supporting Western sanctions until now. I mean, if you look at the Egyptian numbers, 49% of respondents said that they would support increased sanctions against Iran by the end of the year, as opposed to 40. So more people than not are in Egypt were supportive of increasing Western sanctions on Iran. In Jordan, it was more people were against, but the people that were for were 42%, which is a significant number, 42 as opposed to 53% who were opposed. So one of the real stories coming out of the survey is that the U.S. government can go to these regimes and say, look, you know, in Egypt, more people than not are supportive. This is just one survey. I mean, it would have to be confirmed by others, but more, you know, there's room here to say that the street would be behind Mubarak in siding with the West in increased sanctions against Iran. And even in Jordan, even though slightly more people than not, a full 42% said they'd be supportive of the same measure, so the U.S. government could go to Abdullah and say the same thing. So I think, Ray, I think that's it, and I'll take some questions.
Sounds good. Excellent.
Okay. To join the question and answer session queue, press star 1 on your telephone keypad. I will announce each caller prior to bringing you into the conference. Please remember that if you have your phone on mute, take it off mute when you are selected to ask your question. Again, to join the question and answer session queue, press star 1 on your telephone keypad.
I'd like to offer a quick question. Tell me, Adam, as I'm sure you know, paranoia runs rampant in the Middle East amongst the general populace from their regimes. And so what I'm wondering is, even though it seems like you've taken a lot of measures to make it appear very objective, such as going inside the people's homes and interviewing them face-to-face, do you still think that there is still an element of reticence on the people's part out of just sheer paranoia that somehow they're being tracked down and that their views will eventually be used against them?
This is one of the biggest surprises for me in researching this for the last couple of years, and actually going over there and talking, you know, debriefing the field workers. And I mean, I speak a little Arabic now, so I was able to talk about it. And I got the impression that Arabs in general, I mean, this is they really have a lot to say when you sit them down. They really want to talk about a lot of stuff. I mean, if you go in there and you ask about their own regimes, they're going to shut down. But if you go in and ask questions like we were asking, and the response rate is much higher than what you'd find in the United States and many other Western countries, people really want to talk about stuff. And if you can get them to feel comfortable, and granted, you know, some countries are easy. I mean, these Jordan, for instance, people are more easily speak their minds than in Egypt, and Egypt much more than Syria. But the truth is, if you can get them in these kinds of environments and you can ask certain questions, they really want to talk about stuff, and their awareness of things is in details, like the president's speech, for instance. Even if they didn't watch it in person, and many more people watch it in person than would be in the Western country of the United States, they read about it in the newspaper, and their awareness is much higher than you'd expect. So I think there's a lot of misinformation being spread about Arab political polling, and if done properly, you can elicit really good information.
Right.
There are no questions at this time. Again, if you'd like to ask a question, just press *1 on your telephone keypad.
I'd like to get some more of your thoughts, Adam, on the phenomenon of Hugo Chavez getting that sort of attention.
Right.
What that purports.
I think that what will happen is a lot of these surveys, as far as the Zogby case, there was a lot of manipulation of the weighting. I think that there was, instead of asking it as an open-ended question where you just write it down, you'd be given a series of examples and you'd have to choose. I suspect that a lot of people knew that it was being done in concert with the government, and therefore, he might have been the safest choice. It's interesting that every year there'd be another rejectionist. I mean, one year it was Nasrallah, another year was Ahmadinejad, another year was Chavez. So, I mean, David Pollack and I were very suspect of this. Just having studied the Arab world now for a couple of years, and it's too incredulous to me that he would get such a number without being led to sort of select him. That's not to say, by the way, the other surveys are not totally without value. I mean, there's so little polling done that part of the service that these polls are doing is sort of validating or calling into question some of the other findings. And you got to sort of look at it as a whole. I mean, it's not like the New Hampshire primary where there's like 10 different polls polling at the same time and you can sort of see what's right and what's not.
Right.
We have a question from Mr. Alan Ross. Go ahead, Mr. Ross.
Hi. I came in a bit late, so if you answer this, I apologize. When you do a poll, as you know, you try to poll a universe. It's not an entire society. You're trying to poll, in the United States. You could be wanting in the United States to poll women or likely voters or voters, and as you know, the results are very, very different depending upon who you are polling. Who did you try to poll here in the sense of the society? I mean, are you trying to poll the entire society, or is there a subgroup here that you concentrated on?
Thanks for the question, Alan. What I learned in doing this, and I worked, as I said, with David Pollack, who did this for the U.S. Information Agency. If you have 1,000, I mean, you can get a great sample of both Egypt and Jordan with 1,000 face-to-face interviews in people's homes. I mean, the margin of error for each of these surveys is like 2.9%. Mm-hmm. And the way it was constructed by the field, by the way, I was pleasantly surprised. The field organization I used, I had been used by a lot of these really effective entities over time. And, you know, a lot of stuff that's passed on in the United States, I mean, you'll read the New York Times or Washington Post and they'll cite a phone poll, and it'll just be like no one will even question whether it's effective or not. I was amazed at how statistically based these surveys were, where they were getting their information from the Bureau of Statistics. I just was giving a briefing at the Council on Foreign Relations, and somebody started looking through at the back of the top line results. You'll just see a breakdown of who the people were, and they were questioning the urban-rural breakdown of Egypt, because if you look at it, you know, it's I don't have it in front. I'm looking at it right now, but it was more rural than you would expect. And one of the people who works for the council told his assistant to go check it online, and it turns out that the Egyptian Bureau of Statistics actually does categorize almost exactly the same as came out in the survey. That you know, maybe they're categorizing certain neighborhoods in Cairo as rural that we'd consider urban. Uh-huh. But the sample was so much more right on to the national sample than I would have even imagined in studying this from afar. And you know, there's still a margin of error, but you know, David was correct. If you do 1,000, you don't have. If you go up to 1,200 interviews, or 15, or 2,000, the nominal it'll just be nominally different insofar as the margin of error. I mean, you go from like 2.9 to 2.7 something. So I hope that answers your question. I think one thing we were doing differently is we weren't lumping the whole Arab world together. We were taking specific countries, and I mean, you know, when you see these Zoghbi surveys or other surveys, which, you know, lump Morocco and Egypt, and you know, I mean, it's really doing the poll and the people reading it a disservice, because
cut you off real quick. We have one more question. We got about 3 minutes.
Okay.
If we can do that. Go ahead, Karen.
We have Mr. Matthew Wasserman. Go ahead, Mr. Wasserman.
Hi, Adam. Matt Wasserman here. Couple things. One, you know, just I'm very interested to see how, you know, over time how the business community could use this type of information, because, you know, as you did show there in the first couple of in a few of those questions, that could be very relevant to, you know, to global businesses. But my question kind of goes to kind of the analysis. I'm not sure how much of analysis you did on the survey yet, but specifically I was struck by questions 8 through 10 in that, you know, I think it's question 9 where you asked about whether or not Obama's speech would help the situation in the region. And it seemed like it got relatively high marks, over 50%. But questions 8 and 10, which spoke to their view on the U.S. and even the view of his credibility, were relatively low. And it just they seemed to be at odds with each other. And was wondering just kind of your thoughts on that and what that means for the U.S. and actually being able to make a difference.
Thanks.
Minutes, Adam.
Okay, thanks, Matt. That's a great question. Actually, if you've been studying, I mean, if you've been researching this, I think the numbers are actually very favorable for the president, because I think you're right that for an American eye to see that distinction between 55 and in the mid-30s, you'd say, but for them to be able to sort of give him a chance on these specific issues between 30 and 40% is a real story. And if you look at the favorability number at Egypt being at 38%, that's routinely 20 points higher than what we've seen in the last 10 years from Egyptian surveys. So you're right. I mean, the broad-based question is different, but it stands in contrast. But the other numbers, I think, are favorable. They're going to give him a chance. I mean, for how long, we'll see. And actually, I'm going to be going into the field once a quarter, and I'm going to be able to, maybe I'll be invited back by Ray to be able to talk about it more.
Thanks.
Okay, Adam.
Thanks.
Thanks very much for that, Adam. That's very useful information. And thank you to all for calling in and participating. And good luck with your project, Adam.
Thank you very much.